nominates, or excuse me, evaluates nominees based on are they qualified or not to hold a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. And yes, they are, for the most part, remarkably impartial. They rated more of Trump's nominees than any other in history as unqualified. So they were attacked as a partisan group as a result. But they really are not. They do a pretty excellent job in that regard. And try to stay nonpartisan so that they can continue to do that. The question is about oral arguments at the Supreme Court involving Indian Welfare Child Act care case that they heard arguments for this morning, and whether or not there are elements of Christian and white privilege in that. Fair? And I do think there are, and there are actually, in the Smith case is one of the cases where there's this question of Native American religions coming in and getting distorted. We often, you'll hear about that case as two Native Americans challenging these provisions. One of them was actually just a white guy. He gets lumped in all the time. There's also another case that I talk about in here involving Native Americans. So it is sort of a common thread. I don't know what the court's going to do with that one because Gorsuch is a little bit of a wild card when it comes to tribal rights. But those elements are certainly run throughout. And I'm not familiar enough with the facts of those cases to say that the court is distorting them, but I would not be at all surprised. You know, one of the things I realized a couple weeks ago, I was giving a book talk in Texas, and I got asked a question, and I realized that because I've been on the front lines of so many of these cases and seen how the court has distorted them, in a way, this is almost autobiographical at times. So I tell the story of the first time I realized the court was just altering reality and how jarring it was. And it was small. It was actually a very small moment. So it was the Town of Greece versus Galloway case. And so this is a case where Town of Greece, New York, and at their town meetings, they have Christian prayers. And every one of their prayers is Christian. And government prayers, like, very clearly unconstitutional and should not be a thing. If you want to know more about that, you can read my first book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. But there's a bad 1983 opinion from the Supreme Court that says, we've been doing it for a long time. It's probably okay. And one of the things courts are supposed to look at when determining whether or not it's okay is who is the audience for those prayers. And Town of Greece giving all Christian prayers. And it's the room is set up like a typical local government room. So you have the podium in the middle of all the rows of chairs where the citizens can come up and address the city councilors who sit up on the dais, you know, behind their desks with their bigger chairs. And the prayer giver walks up to that podium and delivers the prayer. And instead of delivering the prayer towards the city councilors, they actually turned the podium around 180 degrees to face the audience. Like, you can't get a more clear example of this prayer being literally directed at the audience, not at the government itself. So clearly the audience is the citizens. And the Supreme Court just changed that opinion. Anthony Kennedy just said, the audience for these prayers is the city councilors. You know, it's like half a sentence in the opinion. And it's stunning because Americans United, the group I work for now, is the group that took that case. And one of the things that made that case so great was that every prayer was Christian and that very clearly that fact was on our side. And it was so clearly on our side that the court just changed it. And got noticed nowhere. Kagan calls it out a little bit in her dissent, but just to correct it, not to actually call it out and point out that they're changing it. And you go from that to the case of the coach this term at the Supreme Court. And that one is just, I mean, the court lied to us in that opinion. There is no other way to put it. So that was a case involving a coach that would go to the 50-yard line and pray with student athletes. And we know for a fact that students felt pressured to pray to play. They felt like they had to pray if they wanted to play. That is in the record. There's no doubt about it. And at the lower court, at the Ninth Circuit, The judge, one of the judges, actually calls out the crusader in this case. It's a group called First Liberty Institute, the group representing the coach, and says that they are spinning a, quote, deceitful narrative. The judge actually compared the arguments they made to the real facts in a chart in the opinion. I've never seen anything like this. If a judge said that I was spinning a deceitful narrative, I would go bury my head in the sand for like a year before I would ever consider arguing something again before a court. The crusader appealed to the Supreme Court because they knew that that Supreme Court, the justices there, were going to be more receptive to those lies. And that court, the Supreme Court, adopted the deceitful narrative wholesale, presented it as truth, to the point where Justice Sonia Sotomayor included photographic evidence to the contrary in her dissent. Three photographs showing this judge with players, with other adults, in the middle of the field having these prayers, even though the crusaders are saying, oh no, this is just a moment of personal quiet prayer. So I would be not at all shocked to learn that they are torturing facts in this case as well. I think it's one of the harder things for people to grasp about this court. And it's one of the things that made the work of writing this book so rewarding. I mentioned earlier the Colorado Civil Rights Commissioners, who the court labeled as anti-religious bigots. And I got to speak with one of those commissioners. His name is Raju Jairam. In the eyes of history, he is named as a bigot by our Supreme Court. And that's how he's going to be remembered. And as far as I know, I'm the only person, American Crusade is the only book so far to tell the other side, the true side of that story. And the same goes for the other commissioner, a woman named Diane Rice. She got into civil rights because when she was a student at George Washington, she happened to be walking around with several friends on the National Mall and heard a speech about some guy in his dream. That was where she got into civil rights for the first time. And she was labeled an anti-religious bigot. The quote that the court called anti-religious was Raju Jairam trying to quote a New Mexico Supreme Court opinion. He was paraphrasing it. He doesn't have the kind of recall. And it's one of the same opinions that Ruth Bader Ginsburg used in her Hobby Lobby dissent. She wasn't anti-religious. Neither was the New Mexico Supreme Court. This court manufactured hostility and labeled two very diligent civil servants as bigots to give this bakery a get-out-of-jail-free card. Yeah, so the question is, how does this translate to lower courts, and is there any hope Biden will do something to counteract this? Fair summation. So, I mean, it translates in really awful and remarkable ways. I do talk about lower courts quite a bit in the book, including how emboldened we're seeing them right now. In the coach decision, the court, I'm going to get into a little bit of legalese here. There's something called the Lemon Test, which is based on a case where the Supreme Court, back more than 50 years ago, looked at all of the times that religion and the law had clashed and synthesized all of those cases into three basic principles that courts should look at when they're deciding, does this violate the separation of church and state? And the court has been gunning for that decision for a long time. And in the Coach case, they didn't do what they did in the Dobbs opinion and come out and say, we are overturning the Lemon case, as they said, came out and said, we're overturning Roe. They said, that decision's been criticized for a long time. It's basically been on a shelf. That was the phrase Gorsuch used. And that gives license to any lower court judge that doesn't like the controlling opinions of the court to ignore those controlling opinions so long as they can point to some criticism of an opinion or the fact that the courts may not have used it in every single case throughout history. Oh, they didn't use it there. It was put on a shelf. And we really are seeing, that's just one example recently that happened that's fresh in my mind. We are seeing just this is happening at every level, especially in some of the more conservative circuits, the Fifth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, the 8th Circuit. They are emboldened for sure. Biden, in his first year, outpaced Trump for appointing judges. So has been trying to rebalance the judiciary. I don't think any of that, it matters and it's important, but it also matters that we do that at the Supreme Court itself. Yeah, so the questions about historical parallels. There are a lot of really fascinating aspects. I focused on the cases from the last decade. And I actually, there's a call that this Supreme Court under Roberts issues for a crusade. This didn't just happen spontaneously. The court called for this crusade in a case in 2010 involving a Christian cross in the Mojave Desert. But I mean, that's just the culmination of the crusade. The roots of it are much deeper and further back in our history. And really, a lot of them go back to Brown versus Board of Education. Right? It goes back to why, again, are we seeing this crusade? It's to preserve that dominant group status. And so much of what we are seeing can you can really trace directly back through to Brown versus Board. I mean, even the decision in the Dobbs case, even overturning Roe versus Wade, can be traced right back to that. I mean, we know that abortion was not an issue that certainly the religious right and the moral majority cared about at the time the Roe opinion came down. Catholics, for the most part, cared about it, but that was pretty much it. 5 years after, they chose abortion as the wedge issue to divide the American electorate because they knew that overt racism and segregation was no longer palatable to enough people for them to use it to gain any type of political power. And so, we see a lot of that. The push for school vouchers goes directly back to Brown versus Board of Education, is directly an attempt to maintain segregated public schools. I mean, that is why we have school choice goes directly back to that as well. And I do trace a lot of that history in the later chapters of the book, especially when I get into the cases involving public schools. It's a fascinating and very terrifying history. So yes, historical parallels for sure. Yeah, so what are the demographic trends, basically, is the question. I mean, so they are certainly on the wane. And I think it depends on the studies you look at, but there are a few trends that become clear. You are seeing a rise of the nones, the N-O-N-E-S, right? Non-religious Americans are continuing to grow and grow and grow at the expense of all white Christians for the most part. Nones also seem to be solidifying as a potentially powerful political bloc. You also see it in less obvious trends, right? We had our first black president. We had almost a first female president. We have our first female black vice president now. It's things like that, too, that are very scary for them. I mean, the Obama presidency in particular, like, did a number on the psyche on that side. It's not because, again, it's them sensing a threat and them sensing feeling the waning of their power and their privilege more than what the demographics necessarily actually say. Though I do think that's a big part of it, because they're looking out in their churches and their pews and they're seeing, you know, no young smiling faces looking back at them. And they can read the demographic trends, but for the most part, going very quickly away from them. A good marker for the demographics is we know a lot about Christian nationalism now, and we've been studying a lot more about that. And I do talk about that a lot more in my first book, and this book is dedicated to Christian nationalists. These are the people who believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, that we're based on Judeo-Christian principles, and that we've strayed from that foundation. And they use the language of return and getting back to our godly roots to justify all manner of hateful public policy and other actions. Things from anything from the family separation policy at the border, which a lot of people forget Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Jeff Sessions both justified by citing Romans 13 in the Bible, to the Muslim ban, to the insurrection. I helped spearhead a report about the role that Christian nationalism played in that insurrection, and it ended up becoming testimony for the January 6th committee. We know that demographically about a quarter of the country are very strong Christian nationalists. About another quarter are like lukewarm Christian nationalists. Another quarter are opposed generally to the idea. And then another quarter are very opposed. That would be me. There's some really great, two really phenomenal sociologists, Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry, who've done really amazing work on this. They wrote a book called Taking America Back for God. And then Perry wrote another one with Gorski called The Flag and the Cross, which is in a really short primer. If you really want to dig into more of the demographics of this, those would be the two places I would point you to. And Perry and Whitehead actually also just wrote, I believe, an op-ed for Time, I think it was, that came out this morning, kind of breaking down what we know from the elections and the shift there already. So those would be the three resources I would direct you to for more detail. So can legislation fix some of these problems is the first question. And your hopscotch back and forth, are you asking if we expand the court, what happens? Or... So, I mean, I think my answer to your first question, we'll get to the second one then. One of the themes of American Crusade is that this court wants to take these cases because it is desperate to create this weapon, to redefine religious freedom as a weapon of privilege for the select few. If Congress were to pass a law, let's just use abortion as the example. Let's say Congress codifies Roe in the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a very real possibility and I hope happens. That is going to end up back before the Supreme Court at some point. I mean, guaranteed, they will figure out a way to get it there, and this court wants to take these cases. In a lot of respects, the end of Roe is just the beginning. They're not done with the right to an abortion. I mean, we all saw that this... We'll leave it to the states. It was bull. We all knew that was from the beginning. They're coming for contraception. They're coming for marriage equality. They're coming for everything. They are not going to stop unless we stop them. And I don't think you can do that with legislation. There have been a lot of really great, in the results of the election, a lot of people have really great ideas, things we can do, Green New Deal, all this awesome stuff. None of that is going to work unless you fix the court first. The first thing you have to do is expand the Supreme Court, and then you have to do serious democratic reform, small d democratic reform, to protect and expand the franchise. If you don't do those things, nothing else matters. All of the legislative solutions are band-aids that are going to get ripped off by the court. Yeah, I mean, the questions about the trans panic and demonizing trans people, and especially related to public schools. I mean, they are always looking for a new demon, literally, to put out in front of the people, to scare them, to fearmonger. I unfortunately, there was a section in the book that I had to end up cutting in the end that talks specifically about the neuroscience of fearmongering that Fox News and a lot of the right-wing media outlets engage in. I was a neuroscience major in undergrad, and so it was too much of a tangent, really, to put in a law book, but... I actually, if you want to read it, I put it up on my Patreon page. But they need a bad guy around which to unite. And it's one of the things that their side does really, really, really well. Their side is far better at storytelling, in part because they're not bound by the truth. But, I mean, think about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the gay wedding cake case, right? I mean, that was a case about a company, a business, discriminating against a minority that is protected because of the historical hate that it has suffered. And by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was a case about a poor, persecuted Christian artist who just wanted to do his own art and the government wouldn't let him. The government was forcing him to go against the Bible. I mean, they do a phenomenal job pushing their narratives. It's not grassroots, is what I'm trying to get at here. It's all very, very top-down, and I think that the trans panic that we're seeing is a very, very big part of that. I'm legitimately I have a number of trans friends who I've worked alongside in this movement. I've written alongside in this movement. I'm legitimately afraid for a few of them who are in not safe states any longer. I think when I said that we had a long road ahead of us, I should have added that I think things are going to get worse before they're going to get better. And I think, in particular, I'm worried about our trans brothers and sisters and cousins and siblings taking the brunt of that if we're not careful. Last question. Lifetime appointments, and it's not written in the Constitution, is a question. Where does that come from? It's in the Constitution. The language is have their appointments during good behavior, which has been interpreted to mean the only way you can get them off is through impeachment. And lifetime appointments are meant to be one way to have checks and balances on other branches of the government. Right? We have three branches of government. They're supposed to check and balance each other. And impeachment is supposed to be a check. A lifetime appointment is supposed to be a check on the other branches, too. They're not supposed to be beholden politically to these other branches. Congress is not supposed to, can't change the salary of the judges for the, once they're on for the same reason. It's meant to be a check. We've seen that impeachment is not really a check. I'm going to take your question as, what about some of these other solutions to the court? Term limits. I don't think you get to term limits because of that language, because we have lifetime appointments, because it comes from constitutional language, and the people who interpret that constitutional language are the people whose power you're trying to take away. There are some really creative solutions that you might be able to work around. All of them are really geared at removing that lifetime appointment, so I think it's hard. I think the institutionalist argument is you expand the Supreme Court. Not only have we done that 7 times in our history, which is like every 35 or 40 years or so, the court and the Congress and the executive are meant to balance and check each other. And one of the ways that Congress can check a court that is drunk on power, which is what we have right now, is by expanding and changing the court. And by the way, Mitch McConnell did it when it was politically convenient for him. He knocked it down to 8 for more than a year. And then when it was politically convenient, he put it back up to 9. Let's expand the court. Thank you.
You were just listening to Andrew Seidel, Weaponizing Religious Freedom. He spoke at the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison in mid-November 2022. Andrew Seidel, a constitutional attorney, is vice president of Americans for Separation of Church and State. He's the author of American Crusade. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Medea Benjamin, Juan Gonzalez, Vijay Prashad, Rami Khoury, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Andrew Seidel, Weaponizing Religious Freedom, and his book, American Crusade, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Norm Stockwell and the Progressive Magazine. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers singing Atheists Don't Have No Songs.
This is the entire atheist hymnal right here.
Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Hallelujahs for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Romantics play
Clair de Lune.
Clair de Lune.
Born again, sing He is Risen. But no one ever wrote a tune for godless existentialism.
For atheists, there's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith
in their songs.
They have a rule. The he is always lowercase. The he is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a bacchantata.
Bacchantata.
Lutherans get Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada.
Up to nada.
But they do have Sundays free.
Have Sundays free. Pentecostals sing.
They sing to heaven.
Sing to heaven.
Coptics have the Book of Scrolls. Numerologists count. They count to seven.
5, 6, 7.
Atheists have rock and roll.
For atheists, there's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith
in their songs.
They have a rule. The he is always lowercase. The he is always lowercase.
Atheists don't have no songs.
Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Hava Negilas for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Catholics dress up for mass
and listen to Gregorian chants.
Atheists just take a pass.
Watch football in their underpants. Watch football in their underpants.